Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And you're listening to the New Statesman podcast. This week we will be digesting the battle for number 10. Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn face off both audience, actual people, and Jeremy Paxman.
We'll be wrangling over whether or not the polls are right.
And whether or not Stephen is wrong, or indeed I am wrong. And we'll also be chatting a little bit about the young people. What do they want? Can they be stopped? Stephen, you stayed up to watch the Corbyn May face off, except it wasn't. It was them facing off with actual humans and animatronic Jeremy Paxman. Who do you think won?
Jeremy Corbyn. I don't, to be honest, Stephen, think it was arguable. The distance. Well, no. I'm gonna finesse that slightly. My expectation going into it was that Jeremy would win it handily. He's very good at that kind of Q&A question time style format. I expect him to win the Friday question time style format, which some of our listeners will have watched, and for some of you it will still be in the future as it is for us. Because obviously I have seen him at more hustings than I care to think about.
Yeah, I thought there was a really interesting bit when the guy brought up the IRA stuff. Oh, no, sorry, it wasn't the IRA stuff, although I thought he dealt with that very well. It was when the man said, I'm a business owner and I really don't want... I'm worried about you banning 0 hours contracts, imposing minimum wage, and I don't think I'll be able to pay the VAT on private school fees, which someone sent a great tweet about, which was like, how can I, a literal pharaoh with hundreds of slaves, possibly vote Labour now? It was like, well, I just think, you know, Labour could change all of its policies in order to appeal to people like you, or you could accept that your priorities are conservative priorities. But nonetheless, Jeremy Corbyn gave a very good answer to that question, which ended in a kind of, which is a nice way to end, right? When it's properly rousing kind of preacher, like, I want a society that does this and this and this and this. And it reminded you of the fact that he has bellowed into thousands of crowds his vision for a good society.
Yeah. I think the most important change, though, is that Jeremy's one big flaw in that format is he gets angry and he bares his teeth and it really looks particularly bad on camera. And the leader's office had been aware of this and they had prepared for it. And actually, Jeremy Paxman, who mostly had a night to forget, I think did come in with a good plan A, which is if you want to get good, if your main priority is good television rather than scrutiny, parking for a moment, and I imagine we will discuss elsewhere in this podcast the balance between good TV and good scrutiny. But If what you want is good telly, it makes sense to kind of try and irritate Jeremy Corbyn. We sort of know that's his flaw in interviews. However, he does do that.
Let me finish.
Yeah. However, he'd clearly prepared not to be irritated. It didn't work, and it just meant that you had like the kind of
he was super jovial about the answer about the Queen when he was just like, "I love the Queen. She and I, we went skateboarding together. We had great times."
Yeah, I thought May would be worse than she was. She had flashes of the things I kind of. Yeah, the reason you kind of feared for May going into the tie is that awful death stare she gives people who ask her bad questions, which you can get away with doing to journalists because we are, you know, rightly despised. But you can't do to members of the public.
She did it to Quentin Letts. It's a great clip. Quentin Letts of the Daily Mail asked her a question, which I think comes across really badly. It comes across as give us a smile, love, right? Which is sort of like, you know, why aren't you're a bit of a glum bucket? Why aren't we seeing you cheering up? But there's a moment where she just looks like You kind of want a kind of crackle of thunder in the background, like a da 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 da.
Yeah.
And yeah, like you say, if you do that to Joyce 43, who's asked you about the, you know, pupil premium, then it's bad. That is bad times. But also, I thought that actually there was a really good, interesting lesson in how a rhythm of a political interview that Paxman did in that question to her, which was just he built up a case, right? It was quite prosecutorial. He went through U-turn after U-turn.
But he was so in love with interrupting both of them that she paused while struggling and he interrupted, giving her a moment to catch her breath.
Well, that's something that Emma Barnett on Women's Hour with Jeremy Corbyn did much better, which was just to let the silence hang as he flailed wildly trying to find the figures on his iPad, which was actually much more damning than it would have been to kind of just go and keep interrupting.
Yeah, no, I agree. I want to stick on battle for number 10 because then we can have a fight about the Emma Barnett interview. But she did do a better job of boring the audience into submission with these very long answers that by the end she could have said, and also I will kill the firstborn. And you go, yeah, seems reasonable. The thing which would...
But Jess Buchanan did that as well.
Yeah, but he just conveyed more warmth.
He did convey more passion and more, yeah. I thought actually, do you know, I listened to him and I thought, well, I was thinking, I'm quite glad that somebody's kind of saying these things and just not backing down when people come back at him. That sort of swelled a little bit of my left-wing heart.
It's interesting because obviously you can't ever tell how much campaigns matter, how much good campaigns, you know, if you have two good campaigns against each other, how much they cancel each other out, etc., etc. But we are going to have a very good idea at the end of this election, just how much the kind of fundamentals going into a campaign matter and how much the decisions you make in the short campaign matter. Because Labour and Corbyn have done everything right and the Conservatives have done everything wrong. So if the result
apart from having a leader that is still, even though her popularity has dropped by 40 points, it's dropped to a plus number rather than a minus.
That's not a campaign effect.
Going into the campaign with the Conservatives is an advantage.
It's kind of like, you know, the things you can't control, you know, how popular, well, obviously, you know, in terms of the things which are set in stone at the start of the election, how popular are your respective leaders? What's the state of the economy? Is the press on side? You know, all of those various factors, right? But, and the kind of machinery, the back room of the Conservative campaign is still quite good, which in an odd way makes the bit where any politician has to make a decision and then they make the bad one even more noticeable, because it is, sorry, sports metaphor, like watching a team do a great passing move to a donkey who then kind of just brays at the ball for a bit instead of putting it in the back of the net.
Good sports metaphoring. I thought Rachel Sylvester had a good point in her column this week, which was talking about how May used sort of off the back of the G7 summit to mischaracterise Jeremy Corbyn's argument on terrorism. And she compared that to George Osborne using the kind of threat of the emergency budget and the full weight of being in government to try and bludgeon the Leave campaign. And in both cases, they came across as someone being quite manipulative in an unpleasant way. Now, the trouble is, you can say someone coming off as unpleasant and manipulative is a price you have to pay sometimes for manipulating people in a way that works for you. But I think that the fascinating thing is the way that the May campaign is now being read, in the sense of, because everyone still expects her to win, what comes afterwards, and the fact that she will emerge from it a weakened prime minister with her own party, instead of having had this kind of coronation and everyone feeling grateful to her, she's already a bit damaged, which is fascinating, because the same thing happened to, you know, David Cameron. We were all getting all these sort of flowing op-eds about how, because he delivered a majority when he was only expected to get hung parliament, now, you know, the party was reunited behind him, and then, you know, a year later he was gone.
Yeah, but it is worth noting with David Cameron that despite 2 years that had a number of unforced errors by his chancellor, a referendum on a subject where most of his parliamentary party were privately opposed, he still got a majority of Conservative MPs to row behind him, albeit a lot of them kind of went, yeah, I back it, and then said nothing else. But he did command quite a lot of residual affection. And when you consider that they once again... And yeah, so I think a couple of things. One, we kind of forget how much the goodwill Cameron had did hold things together for a year which would otherwise have been quite a traumatic one in the life of the Conservative Party. You know, a public fight over an issue which has basically split them since the 70s. And if you widen Europe to be about trade, yeah, kind of in some ways it is the ancient conservative fissure running right back to their point of origin under Peel, right? So the fact that the party didn't ever look like it was going to tear asunder does show how much that goodwill matters. I am yet to speak to a conservative MP who, obviously there are no MPs because there's no parliament, but you take my point, who has said to me, in, you know, kind of sincerely, then they don't now think that whatever result they get will be more about their opponents than them.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And I also think that there is a feeling of misery generally about the manifesto and about the feeling that there were no... The Labour Party manifesto was all cookies and sprinkles, and theirs was all porridge and carrots. And actually, the porridge and carrots are being taken away from you. And actually, they really wished that there had been a couple of, you know, a couple of big... nice giveaways that they could have changed the subject to. But actually, one of the big problems with the social care policy was there was nothing to pivot to, except, as we've seen now this week, Brexit.
Which... I mean, the thing is, they're actually... So Chris Dillow, who's a kind of a blogger and economist who I greatly admire, has done a really great blog about, like, who is Mayism for? And this thing's just like, who are the... You know, kind of, if you take Margaret Thatcher... She had a diagnosis of where the economy is that obviously lots of people disagree with, but she had this idea that, you know, you got growth by deregulating, weakening the trade unions, and she had a series of people who became winners, people who became asset rich, people who were able to retire to the Costa del Sol, etc., etc. George Osborne, equally, he and Cameron had winners. They had dual earner childless couples and...
Me. He had me.
And boomers, yeah.
And you.
And, yeah, right.
I mean, George Osborne's winners, right. Cruel as it may seem.
But, and you know, taken together, okay, not every... You know, some elderly boomers went, you know what, I don't need this. Some dual earner childless couples did. But taken together, that was enough in the right seats, in the right places to get their solid 37% of the vote. The weird thing about Mayism is, one, I mean, who are the people who will be better off under it? I mean, they still have the Bungford dual earner couples with the threshold raise, and they've got the 40p raise, although obviously Labour is matching both of those. But who are the people who are better off? Is it private tutors who will teach middle class kids how to game the 11 plus?
Is it yes, people they will who, do quite well.
Is it people who will get
the
elderly people to
the manufacturers of Cocoa Pops will probably do pretty well with those 7p really? School breakfasts?
But, and the thing is, right, is, you know, like, these are, you know, no shade to any of these people, but they are not big enough groups to form an electoral majority, right? There is no... And also, in terms of, like, the kind of long, flowery passages, which, I mean, it really did feel like a rubbish column by someone desperately trying to tell you how intelligent they were, the Conservative Manifesto. But the
casual subtweet of 90% of your colleagues.
But the other sort of problem with it, right, is what is the... Imagine that Osborne's economic policy worked, right? There is a vision of a country which where the North has become... Where Manchester has become a great sort of financial and trading and tech centre like London, where we have low debt, low tax, blah, 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 all of that, right? As it happens, I think there's a massive hole in that marked his inability to actually... You can't achieve in a democratic system the deficit reduction plans he claimed Osborne. To want to. Yeah. However, there was actually a plan at the end of it. Whereas,
I think
like, what is the plan?
Whatever the Northern Industrial Strategy turns out to be, is not one that will bear fruit for years and years and years and years. I think, actually, I quite enjoyed Jan Ganesh's column this week, which said, you know, the trouble is that there are massive cash transfers from London and the southeast to the rest of the country. You might take a gamble that actually people are willing to pay a price for lower immigration, but all the research suggests, you know, they did that research before the referendum last year, which said, how much would you be willing to pay in order to cut immigration? And the vast majority of people, it was like under 25 quid. For a lot of people, it was literally zero.
Yeah, I think immigration is a bit like... the kind of Labour Party thing of, but the policies and the manifesto are popular. It's just like, yeah, but, and it might be different this time, but historically what has tended to happen is people go, I love these Labour policies. Yeah, I'm into them. I'm definitely going to vote for them. And then you go like, are you willing to pay for them? And they go, oh no, are you mad? And I think immigration is sort of like that for the right.
But that's what really, really worries me about this election. So when I was out in Halifax, I asked Holly Lynch, who's a Labour candidate there, saying, you know, does immigration come up much in the doorstep? Because in 2015, it absolutely did. You talk to any candidate and they said, that's when people are really, you know, it's number one issue along with the economy. And he said, no, it's, you know, it's people sort of think that Brexit has settled that. And I think that is a problem. People have just sort of assumed, actually, and there hasn't been that much discussion about immigration because it's assumed that it will go down as a result of Brexit. If it doesn't, I think that's toxic because it's another broken promise. And it's a bit, and remember how, you know, tuition fees has poisoned the Lib Dems with an entire cohort. It's a broken promise to a big, big electoral cohort. And it is also the fertile ground for, which I can kind of feel already happening, the revival of UKIP as a party which is much closer to the BNP. I think where you're finding UKIP support now is closer to the support of a proper hard, hard right party. And that's, you know, with Paul Nuttall saying that he'd be, not only does he want people hanged, he'd be happy to hang them himself, like from a tree in his garden. You know, you can feel where that party is going.
Yeah, I think the interesting, I think there are a lot, so many interesting things about UKIP's, whether it's death or kind of weird retreat into a kind of cocoon to emerge as a kind of larger BNP butterfly. The first is, I do think the different treatment of Paul Nuttall and Nigel Farage does reveal something interesting and distinctive about the British class system, right?
Huh, oh, that's interesting, because I've always seen that through the prism of the Tory right found Nigel Farage very useful as a kind of bulwark against backsliding from Cameron, and it was in their interest to boost him. But you think the fact that he's Scouse versus a kind of larky public schoolboy,
yeah, I mean,
is driving that.
Farage was in many ways a more actually, an interesting question: is Farage a better politician, or does he just have natural? Because obviously, Theresa May, I don't think, is as good a politician as David Cameron, but her biography, the way she sounds, yeah. The thing I'm really struck by before the social care thing, you'd go around the country and people would say, "Oh, she seems like she's like me." Is that being a good politician? Is that just like the gift of genetics and voice? But whichever, Farage had this thing where he both was able to come across as, I'm like you, I didn't go to university, particularly like, you know, men of a certain age who for one reason or another feel fairly disappointed in their lives. You know, their high street clothes, their jobs, you know, whatever. He was able to speak directly to them while also being in the kind of milieu of the kind of BBC Booker, you know, the kind of like posh people asking
He'd
questions.
He'd know what fork to use. He wouldn't disgrace himself at Ascot.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
And it's so kind of the Burka ban is a vintage Farage. I'm going to say something awful and get people to talk about it, and this will mean people will write up UKIP. But the problem for Paul Nuttall is he's obviously from Merseyside. He's got, you know, no hair. He just looks more thuggish, right? And Farage's great achievement was he got the vote share that the BNP could get if it could appeal to people who used coasters. But there's something innately non-aspirational and kind of
think there's
low
a thing
about voting for the BNP, which you see even in sort of like bits of East London where people vote for the BNP, right? There are people who, you know, you'd knock on the door and you'd think exactly the same background, hear their accent exactly the same background. But there's a sense in lots of communities that, like, if you vote for the BNP, you're admitting you've had a rubbish life. And Farage was able to bust UKIP out of that cage. Nuttall is kind of pulling them back into it.
Yeah, I also think, I was thinking about this morning with relation to, like, how much people love Emmanuel Macron kind of giving the smackdown to Donald Trump and to Vladimir Putin, right? There is a sense that what people want in politicians is, like, we want our bully. We want somebody who will be slightly, like, cruel and sort of smack people down publicly on behalf of the values that we hold dear, right? So liberals love Macron doing the, like, tight, grippy handshake or the kind of, you know, I ban Sputnik News because it's an organ of influence stuff. Stuff that is kind of slightly dickish, I guess, you know, has a slight edge to it because he's our dick, basically. And that's, you can then appreciate why maybe people like that so much in Farage, who definitely was like, he's our dick, right? He's the guy who comes into this very cozy club and just says things that, you know, no one wants to hear.
He speaks to the MEPs after Brexit, you're not laughing anymore. And the thing I'm, yeah, the kind of, I mean, they're, you know, there are so many fascinating undercurrents that we don't really talk about enough in the vote. But the thing I'm continually fascinated by is this really strong need among a section of people who voted Leave to believe no one who voted Remain saw it coming.
Oh, I love that. I love that. When they just, we've upset a incredibly complacent political class. And I think it's about sort of like a lone voice in the wilderness thing. I think if you've devoted that many years of your political career to this and been dismissed as a crank, then you've got to kind of roll around in it. I mean, don't tell me you're not preparing a little list of people who've told you that you were kind of completely wrong about things when the election is over so that you can go back to them and just have a little tiny gloat.
I kind of feel if I'm right about the election, my plans will be largely to cry, TBH. But
yeah, but a little bit of schadenfreude will really make the medicine go down.
But you know, no, I think, to be honest, I'm just...
But people are madly invested in that, right? People are completely... People tell me all the time no one saw Trump coming, and you're like, I'm going to dig you out the tweet where I said that it's going to happen. They're just really into this idea that all predictions are wrong, no one's seen anything coming.
Yeah,
but that's the power of narrative, isn't it? It's the way that they don't wrap in the far-right candidate being defeated in Austria, say, or, you know, Macron's victory is not over-interpreted to mean anything difficult. I just...
Yeah, and I think, I think the interesting thing is, I think if UKIP can survive financially, which is obviously the big problem for them, they will revive. I reckon they will probably need to get another leader who can once again, you know, do that kind of class finessing that Nuttall just can't do. Right?
I agree with you. The whole thing about having somebody who's privately educated from the south but didn't go to university is pretty much the sweet spot, because you're giving both people, you know, both non-graduates, there a bit of biography for them, and you're giving the respectability that other people want.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And now it's time for a section we like to call...
You Ask Us. Somebody has offered to do a jingle for me, which I haven't got back to yet because I've been away. But I'm really excited, Stephen. This time next week, we could have a jingle.
Oh, let the joy be unconfined. So anyway, the question is, why are people getting excited about all of this? Again, their words, not mine. Have we forgotten that Twitter North is not a constituency?
You mean Labour coming to within maybe 5 to 3 points of the Tories in the polls?
Yeah, and just the general, like, oh, we're doing well in the debates.
Jeremy's, you know, quite lovely when people get to know him.
Yeah, kind of.
The policies are very popular.
Isn't this just what happened with Ed Miliband in the run-up to the 2015 election?
It is, Stephen. That's exactly what it is. And I would like to be the representative for Pissing on Your Chips South and tell you that I don't think that... I think when you probe into the figures, I think that some of them that have got Labour much closer are assuming levels of turnout among young people, which I think are unlikely to happen. I think when you look at the other figures, like who's the best leader, who's most trusted on the economy, those are pretty bleak, and they were a better indicator in 2015. And also, I think probably even if Labour do a better vote share than Ed Miliband last time, which is entirely possible, I think that vote is probably not in great places. I think if you look at the kind of seats you expect them to win or lose, I think the picture is not great.
So I partially agree with some of that.
Talk about damning with faint praise. Okay.
Right. So it feels fairly clear to me that the poll surge is actually, there are signs of it happening in real life, right? Then you can tell that Labour is actually successfully swallowing the Greens and the Liberal Democrats.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see it on my own commute into work. You know, kind of, yes, partly that's a private rented sector and the kind of usual churn. But on the same journey 2 years ago, Green and Lib Dem posters are now
votes
Labour
in Hackney
posters.
South for Labour are not what
but
Labour
yeah, so
need
this
right
is,
now.
So, but this is the kind of bit I would agree with, right? It does seem to me that what may be happening is a situation where Labour increases its vote in places it already holds. It makes very strong showings in seats that the Liberal Democrats would hope to have gained from the Conservatives, but obviously they seem to be disintegrating. And this, yeah, however, so that, but yeah, so the kind of, it feels to me the kind of question of, are the polls giving us a true picture of what's happening? Feels to me they certainly are, right? My assumption is always Labour will underperform its polls by about 3 or 4 points. But in terms of the phenomena, that feels about right to me. That
the one thing I will concede to you is that I do think there is a sort of hardening up of the vote. I think lots of Labour people who were maybe flirting with going to the Lib Dems because of Brexit have kind of accepted that this is a Labour versus Tory election. And actually, they're making that protest vote about Brexit is kind of pointless. I think that's definitely happened. And I also think that Jeremy Corbyn's weaknesses were pretty well known before we went into this campaign. To some extent, people had already swallowed them. Before they came in, whereas Theresa May's weaknesses, although pretty well known in Westminster, were not widely shared in the country.
Yeah, and I think because the question in terms of the kind of, because yeah, basically the Labour's increase in the polls is kind of coming from three places. There's people who usually vote Labour who don't like Jeremy Corbyn who are returning to the fold. There are people who actually don't like Labour but are more into Jeremy Corbyn who are voting for the Labour Party, and then there are a kind of, actually, this is not really a separate third group, but they're people in the first group, but they're responding to a different stimuli, right? They're people who didn't come into this election expecting to vote for the Labour Party. They thought, oh, Theresa May seems like a different type of Conservative. Oh, I think I'll vote for the Lib Dems. But for a lot of people, it is an incredible emotional breach to not vote for the Labour Party. And because Theresa May has done so many things to make herself more unattractive,
I think fox hunting was a big misstep,
yeah,
in that.
Because the Liberal Democrats have just had a bit of a mare from soup to nuts. That vote is kind of going, oh, actually, I'm not going to do this emotionally painful thing. I'm just going to vote for the Labour Party. Now, the difficulty is, with a week out, can that coalition hold together, right? Now, obviously, you'd expect the people who are feeling this emotional pull back to Labour to stay the course, but some of them might stay home. You would expect the people who like Jeremy Corbyn, obviously, to vote for the Labour Party. The risk, I think, is if Labour can't turn people around on Jeremy on that kind of, yeah, I thought the people who thought they were voting in an election in which the question was, do I want there to be a Labour Party after this election? Who may get spooked if they feel that they are voting in an election in which the question is,
do I want a Labour government?
Do I want a Labour government, right?
Yeah, I just thought the really interesting thing from the battle for number 10 was that the guy who asked Theresa May a question about social care and was quite emotional about it, you know, just saying, I want a house to pass on to my children, which, you know, we all know, for all that I think inheritance tax is a very good and fair tax, it's a really unpopular tax, right? That is a motivating factor. He said afterwards, though, that he was still going to vote Conservatives. And I think there is a real cohort. I mean, not only when you look at the polling among that age group are they like 50 points ahead of the Tories are over Labour, but also that I think there is a feeling among them that actually no politician would dare screw us over. So actually, whatever they say, we all know that no one's really going to do something terrible to pensioners because there's so many of us and we vote. They've internalised that message.
Well, yeah, and actually, as her U-turn kind of demonstrates, right, it's a bit like when people sneer about, oh, why was Cornwall so silly as to vote against the EU funding. It's like, actually, Cornwall sends, you know, a bumper crop of Conservative MPs to Westminster. They will be fine. Actually, their people's voters' idea of their self-interest is more sophisticated, I think, than a lot of people give it credit for.
So, yeah, that was my feeling, was that when you look at that, you think, I think the social care was bad for them, and clearly the fact that the speediness of their U-turn clearly shows that it hurt them. But I also don't know if necessarily it's enough for people to push people into the arms of Jeremy Corbyn, who's also offering some pretty salty tax and spend plans.
The other sort of part of the coalition that I would usually be more nervous about are young people who don't usually vote. In some of the polls, like Servation suggests 84% of young people voting. That feels unlikely.
Is it like 50% at the last election, 51%, something like that?
Yeah, I think. No, I had looked.
I just looked at your exciting historical poll chart where it kind of went down from sort of 70% and then it bottomed out in 2005, so, and then it ticked up a bit.
The really fascinating trend is that second-term Labour governments, it turns out, are really bad for youth turnout. It drops in 1966, which is weirder because 1966 Labour was looking to increase its majority from 4 to a bigger one, and it got a majority of 90-odd, I want to say. In 2001, you kind of go partly a foregone conclusion, maybe. But it's fascinating because it does together suggest a wider story of kind of disillusionment of Labour in office.
I also think that's kind of complacency. I was thinking about this in the last election, that to people of my generation, you know, I was 14 in 1997, Labour was the establishment. You sort of thought, whatever, you know, happened, but like you kick Labour, yeah, you give Labour a bit of a kicking, but Labour is still in charge, right? I think it took until 2010 for people to really go, oh, right, okay, so actually the Conservatives are the natural party of government.
Yeah, and so there are a couple of reasons why I think the youth turnout may, I mean, yeah, the Servation one, which shows more young people than are registered to vote, saying they will definitely vote, that obviously won't happen. But I think there are many reasons to believe youth turnout will be higher this time than last time. One, again, the historical trend is basically Labour governments reduce youth turnout, Conservative governments increase it, which, yeah, does feel like a fairly obvious, mm-hmm. you know, you don't have to be
two,
a detective.
There is something genuinely different for them to vote for,
yeah,
right? Something that is something genuinely idealistic and is offering a real break.
Three, we know that after a referendum which has had higher the turnout than before, turnout in the election afterwards has been higher. We saw that in the snap election in Northern Ireland after Brexit. We saw that in Scotland, both in Holyrood and in the Westminster election in 2015 after the 2014 referendum. So there are many reasons to be less panicked, I think, by that block of young voters.
Okay, but because we haven't got much time, I am going to wrap up by saying one thing, which is even if Labour are only, quote-unquote, only 5 points behind the Conservatives, that's still not what you'd hope for after 7 years of a Conservative-led or Conservative government.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's still a bad result, particularly against, let's face it, shambolic Conservative Party with
a hugely self-sabotaging manifesto.
Yeah, right. But, and yeah, I do still expect them to underperform, but there are two important caveats there. One, if that were to hold, it would be the difference between a bad and disappointing defeat and between
apocalypse.
What the polls suggested, which would have been a defeat which would have meant that Labour had lost the 2022 election before a vote had been cast.
Yeah.
And secondly, I think what it does show, and I always resile from learning from America because I just think it's not as useful a guide as Europe in terms of our political culture and whatnot. But I do think the one important lesson from the United States is that If your diagnosis of someone's campaign is they have done enough to lose it, they probably still can, even if the other person is not.
You think Theresa May could lose?
Yeah, I think it is. It feels to me, yeah, they may have got the wheels back on the wagon, right? The No Deal line is obviously a crock of a word I can't say without sabotaging our universal rating, but yeah, if they can keep on that, fine. But I just think it is no longer a safe bet to say that if she does erupt on Friday, glare at some voter for having the temerity to ask her a question and goes massively viral, then they can't lose.
I just can't see it. But then maybe, you know, once again, the sage of Bush will emerge next week as the only person.
She might not. They might have got their mistakes out of their system. But I think that
given that this is a Linton Crosby campaign, I just think that there will be nothing of any interest said for next week apart from Brexit. Did you hear about Brexit? Who do you want to negotiate in Brexit? Brexit, though. Brexit. Yay, Brexit.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague Helen Lewis. We're produced by India Bork and mixed by James Shields. You've missed out on the chance to be among the first 10,000 subscribers to my excellent morning email. However, there is still time to be in the top 15,000, but you will have to hurry. Sign up now, it's free. Just search New Statesman Morning Call.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.